I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. An agreement in principle. That's what lawmakers announced just a short while ago after emerging from a closed-door meeting on a Wall Street bailout. Here's Democratic Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut.
We believe that we're prepared to act expeditiously on a package to our colleagues that will allow us to send a message to the markets that the Congress heard the message, and we want to do what's correct and right in the next few days. We can't say exactly when. We've reached a fundamental agreement on a set of principles. One, for taxpayers, which is tremendously important. We're giving the Secretary authority that he will need in order to act and the funding that he will need. We also have dealt, I think, effectively with the issue of effective oversight, with home ownership preservation, as well as executive compensation.
And other lawmakers today, including Charles Schumer and Barney Frank, said they were hopeful that a deal could be struck by a White House meeting this afternoon, but maybe not so fast. Gail Chadwick is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, that was a very exciting moment on television when lawmakers came out and there's you could hear the flashing of the cameras, the light bulbs, and the big, breaking news. But is it as much of a done deal as it was sounding?
It's unraveling even as we speak. Now, how far this goes, it becomes very important, the appearance of John McCain today. And the sense that we have just kind of walking in the corridors and talking to people is that Democrats were very eager to show that, no, they weren't lost in partisan wrangling. They were closing in on a deal. Indeed, they even had a deal before McCain showed up on the white horse at the White House to save the day.
Now, let's remember, for the five people who might have been extremely busy and did not know that yesterday, candidate John McCain, in a very dramatic announcement, said that he was suspending his campaign, and he also wanted tomorrow night's presidential debate canceled because he had to go to Washington to work on the bill. His critics said that he wouldn't get into any of the closed-door meetings, that he had nothing to do with some of this negotiating. But as we're going to hear later, voters across the country applauded that move. So now you're saying there was politics involved today in response to his announcement yesterday.
Your listeners should think about two narratives running on exactly the same track. One is, what do we do to save a struggling financial market? And two, what do we do to save a struggling Republican presidential campaign? And those two narratives meet at the White House this afternoon. And I think what you're seeing today is it's very hard to see how much of it will last, but the segment that you just played for your listeners is our understanding of what Democrats say the deal is. That is, we're basically giving the Treasury Department what they said they wanted. $700 billion authority to buy up these toxic assets. But House Republicans have emerged as the key player here. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, says she won't move on this unless a critical mass of House Republicans supports it.
This is the House Republican Caucus, and we understand a group of them have circulated an alternative idea. And it's funny because we heard Boston University professor Lawrence Kotlikoff on the program yesterday outline, this is an idea he has put forth, that instead of giving Wall Street money, the offer would be made to companies to buy insurance that the government would back, and they could go, these companies could then go and buy some of this bad debt. And we understand these Republicans are really pushing this alternative plan.
If I could lift the phone in my phone booth out into the room, you would hear they're briefing us on this right now. What they're saying is that there are certain principles to an economic rescue. The important one is that instead of providing taxpayer funds to purchase these toxic assets, the government should insure these mm-hmm. assets, back them in some other way. It mm-hmm. ought to be a combination of loans. There ought to be more private capital injected into the markets by, for example, allowing for U.S. companies to bring back all of the assets they have overseas without being taxed on them.
Well, how does this work, though, Gail? Because this is a Republican White House that has asked for this $700 billion bailout. These are Republicans. Yeah, go ahead.
This is a Republican president that has very little credibility with the House members who have to face their voters in a very few number of weeks. Mm-hmm. They do not want to go saying, I just voted to bail out Wall Street at your expense. That's a non-starter. It was interesting to me that the one House Republican at the meeting today that announced a deal, mm-hmm. Spencer Baucus, he's the ranking Republican on the House Financial Services Committee. He just came out and said, you know, we're making progress, but there is no deal. I can't speak for my leadership. I don't even support what they've come up with, but we're making progress.
Well, wait a minute. What about Bob Bennett? Excuse me for interrupting, but what about Bob Bennett, the senator from Utah, the Republican?
That's right.
He spoke today, and he said this has got to be passed. We need this to save the economy.
That's right. There are people that believe that, but House Republicans don't happen to be a part of that critical mass. They're hoping at this last hour, with this sense of urgency, I mean, that is the other sense that's really different today. There are rumors flying around the corridors that the Treasury Secretary has said this, the markets will melt down tonight if we don't do that. You know, this is just, it is a high fear quotient. And there's always a lot of pressure to do things quickly in a high fear quotient. But House Republicans think that even in this climate, they have today, they have tomorrow, perhaps until Sunday. Everyone agrees that something has to be done before the markets open on Monday. But that as long as they're seen as doing something serious and that something will result, the markets will give them extra time. That's the critical calculation that House Republicans are making. They say that a lot of the ideas they're presenting today are John McCain's ideas. If at the end of the day he can get some of these ideas into a final deal and rally critical Republican votes, he does emerge from this as much more of a leader than he was going in.
And briefly, we had understood that the deal that was being shaped over the morning called for an oversight board,
That's right.
For cutting back CEO salaries, put aside the idea of judges being able to manipulate people's mortgages if they couldn't make payments, put that aside for this time, but, you know, came up with some concessions to what people were asking for, but according to these House Republicans, not enough. Well, Gail Chadha, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, this story continues to unfold, but it sounds as if this isn't going to be a very as happy a meeting as we might have thought a half an hour ago at the White House this afternoon.
By 4 o'clock, it may have switched back. What you're seeing
is a lot
of last-minute negotiating.
Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, let's bring in Julian Zelitzer. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Julian, we always ask you to come in and put things in context for us and look at them through sort of a political and historical prism. But how are you looking at this? It keeps moving.
It does keep moving, but this is often what we see in the final kind of hours of a negotiation. Unfortunately, in Washington, often it's the crisis atmosphere that's needed to get legislation through, and certainly to get any kind of bipartisan agreement. So we have that moment of crisis, and now it's if one of the key players can actually bring this together. But it sounds like a tenuous agreement at best.
Well, and let's talk about some of the politics here, because we have to. I mean, as important as the economic issues are, we're in the middle of this presidential campaign, and it's forcing the story to shift. Yesterday, as we said, McCain announces he's going to suspend his campaign. He wants the debates postponed as well. He has critics, including Republican analysts, who aren't named in the Washington Post today, but who say it sounded reckless. It sounds like he's just striking out and flailing around. But Newt Gingrich has said this is one of the greatest things, the most responsible things anyone has ever done. He goes all the way back to Dwight Eisenhower saying that he would go to Korea. Where does John McCain's decision fall?
I don't think this decision yet stands in one of the great decisions of presidential candidates. And I think we have to see what happens. I think there's clearly a political element. You know, McCain wants to look like Republicans care about the economy, and he wants to look like a leader. And that's part of why he did this. And then there's just John McCain, who is kind of that mentality of wanting to save the day that brought him to Washington as well. If a resolution is found and if he can kind of sell the story as his presence being important, I think that will benefit. I think, you know, some of the feedback we've been hearing today about this decision contradicts what a lot of reporters and pundits thought or were saying about the decision. And, you know, there's a lot of animosity about Congress and how Congress doesn't work. And so I think he's trying to play into that. And he might kind of end up doing a better job than we thought simply in terms of the politics.
Will he be able, though, to assuage the people who don't want any bailout? It is just wall to wall on talk radio. I thought Lou Dobbs on CNN last night, I thought his hair was going to catch on fire. It is being sold, it's being talked about in those circles as bailing out people who were stupid, we're hearing, who made bad decisions, you know, people who got into home loans that they couldn't afford, and it's their fault, and they should fail. On the other hand, we're also hearing from people, and we're going to hear in a few minutes, from business people who are saying, wait a second, this isn't about that. This is about me. I have a good business. I'm trying to get a loan. They also, are in the case that we're going to hear, a John McCain constituent, and they want the bailout. So how is John McCain going to walk that line between the people who are railing against the bailout that he's working on and the voters who want it and need it?
That's a tough line. It's a tough coalition he has to build. I think ultimately what you heard from the president last night is the way this is done. It's about creating enough fear about the implications of a further financial collapse so that at least half of the people who are against this, half the House Republicans who are against this, say, you know what? You know, the political fallout from not doing something about a falling economy is much worse than, you know, the effects of a bailout and all the political controversy that it causes. And so fear is an important part of this, and he just needs about half the Republicans in the House to come along. And so, you know, you heard a speech last night by the president warning of recession, and today I think John McCain is putting the weight of his candidacy behind a deal as well, and hopefully that diminishes some of the opposition. Or they'll say, I oppose it, but I'll still vote for it.
Well, Julian Zelicher, we're going to take a quick break in a minute, but I just want to ask you about that speech last night. What was your thought of how the president presented himself? I mean, we think back to some of the other important times he's come before Americans, and let's say in the run-up to the war. If you put the images side by side, the president that we saw last night seemed frightened. And maybe that's going too strong, but he didn't seem... He seemed different from the president who came before Americans and very strongly, forcefully asked for the war in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, I think the similarity is that in a moment of crisis, you know, he does appear before the country. That's when he likes to speak to the nation. And in both times, you know, he's calling for something dramatic. I think with military action, he had more confidence in what he was calling for and what he saw as a solution with Afghanistan and 9/11 originally. And I think there is a certain level of nervousness, inside the White House about what exactly to do. There's not that same confidence that he exhibits because I don't think he has that confidence. And at the same time, I think, you know, there's a strategy. He wants to present a moment of true uncertainty and crisis so that House Republicans think twice before saying no to him. And so appearing nervous can actually work to get this legislation through.
That's Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. We are going to take just a minute break and then come back to ask, well, yeah, but whatever happened to there's nothing to fear but fear itself, put this in some historical context. And don't forget, later in the program, Anna Deavere Smith, but also fighting for rights for Iraq's disabled. A woman in a wheelchair has been wheeling around Baghdad, making that fight for others in wheelchairs alongside her. We'll have that later as well. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. And Julian, we're trying to, you know, put what will be history into perspective, even as it keeps happening under our watch. As we've been talking, let's catch people up. We, about an hour ago, saw a group of legislators come out from a closed-door meeting and very dramatic announcement on CNN that Democrats and Republicans had come up with an agreement in principle on a bailout bill. And we know that there was a meeting scheduled for this afternoon at the White House, both presidential candidates, the president, and these key congressional leaders. And the tone of that press conference was, we got a deal. And then we're hearing that, in fact, House Republicans are saying, no, we don't. And they are working very hard to try to at least appear, we are hearing from our reporter in Congress, to fight the idea of giving $700 billion to the Treasury Secretary's request for a bailout. So Julian, we were just talking about the presidential candidate's role in all of this. And you were saying that, in fact, it's a good thing right now for John McCain that he has the appearance that he's fighting for this, but it's a tough road to hoe for him. Just want to ask, where do you think Barack Obama is in this?
He's in a tough spot. I mean, I think John McCain kind of put him on the spot by doing this, and on the one hand, if he stays on the campaign trail, he plays into this argument that all he really cares about is politics. And it's hard to make the case. It's better for you to hear me on the campaign trail than in the Senate. And on the other hand, even when he goes to Washington, you know, that seems to be drowned out by what John McCain has done. I think ultimately Barack Obama just has to keep talking about what he wants to do, what his position is with this legislation. And I do think it would be in his benefit to try to get in the mix of this last-minute deal, even as he's kind of doing the campaign as well.
Well, we should note that the Obama campaign yesterday, it's not as if they made a huge deal out of it, but did point out that it was Barack Obama who had called John McCain early in the morning to say, should we have a joint appearance? Should we have some sort of bipartisan statement? He left a message. McCain called Obama back later in the day. They talked more about this, and then neither of the camps disagrees that McCain then turned around and made a solo announcement. So the Obama campaign is feeling a little bruised that, in fact, it was their idea and to make the first call to address this in a bipartisan way. But do you think that's just water under this very quickly moving?
Yeah, I mean, that argument is so complex it's impossible to make.
Got confused.
And the other fact is, look, implicitly, Barack Obama is part of the reason Democrats are moving toward an agreement rather quickly, too. They understand they don't want to put him in a position, and they're probably swallowing a lot of this legislation that they don't want either. So both candidates just automatically, because this is an election season, put a lot of pressure on members to find some agreement and to move forward from this. But sometimes it's just hard to translate that stuff into politics. I think, again, Barack Obama's best bet is to focus not only on this legislation, but on what got us to this point and what do we need to do over 4 years, not just over 4 days.
Well, just briefly, John McCain's campaign has announced that they are welcoming news of an agreement in principle, although, as we've been learning, it's not that, you know, solid an agreement yet. He is saying, though, that he still feels that the presidential candidate's first scheduled debate on Friday, for now, should be put off. So we will continue to watch all of this with people like Julian Zelitzer. Julian, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, meantime, what are they saying on Main Street? How is the credit crunch affecting people? And how will that influence the presidential campaign? Ken Barnett is owner of Aqualights in Alpharetta, Georgia. They manufacture lights for boats and marine docks. 2 years ago, his sales were around $2 million. Now they're just over $1 million. He's been trying to get a $500,000 loan to expand. So let's bring him in. Ken, how is that loan request going?
Well, it's pretty tough out there right now. We've talked to several banks, and we either don't have the right mix for collateral or they can't do it for us right now.
Do they tell you because they don't have the funds?
Well, no, they don't ever want to come out and say they don't have the funds. They just say that it's not the proper mix of collateral. It's not something they want to add to their portfolio at the time. However, they would have done it a year or 2 years ago.
That's what they're saying. Well, I know you've been turned down three times. And by the way, when you say they want you to have more collateral, they mean, you know, maybe own the buildings or the land or something like that?
That's correct. They want to see us have a commercial building or something with a lot of equity in it.
Well, but some might say, well, gee, you are saying that your sales are down. Might they just not want to take that risk? I mean, might that be a smart thing?
Well, we're still a profitable company. And however our sales are down, we do have new products to put in the pipeline that will increase sales.
Well, you say that by turning down your loan, you are saying that this is going to further affect the economy. How so?
Well, right now we would like to increase the sales staff and add some people into production. And without getting the loan, we can't hire the 6 to 8 people that we want to increase those departments. The copper that we use starts off in probably Arizona mines, and then it goes to Pennsylvania where it's founded into bars that we take and turn those bars into small parts that we use.
So there's a foundry in Pennsylvania, maybe a copper mine in Arizona, and there's sort of a ripple effect out from you not being able to expand. Are you seeing other businesses impacted by this sort of lack of credit?
Oh, sure. And just in the small industrial complex that we work in, we're seeing people close down and businesses go away. We have a pipe company that sells pipe for irrigation, and they've recently downsized and closed out their facility just right next door, and they've moved out of this town. I have other friends that are in that sell antiques, and they do antique auctions, and even their auctions are way down too.
So, as a business owner, where do you stand on all of this? How do you feel about the bailout?
You know, it's an unfortunate thing that we have to do the bailout, but it looks to be the best thing to do at the moment to stabilize real estate prices. I mean, I've offered to put my house up as collateral too, but the banks aren't interested in houses right now.
And how do you feel about how the two candidates for president are handling all of this? Do you think there's posturing? Do you think they can do anything?
Well, of course I think there's posturing. I think the sad part is it's just an election year, and every time we listen to the news at night and listen to either candidate speak, unfortunately, we hear how bad it is, and I don't think that helps the American public. I appreciate the fact that John McCain is suspending his campaign. He's going to Washington to try to help get this through and so we can get back to normalcy.
Ken Barnett owns Aqualites in Alpharetta, Georgia. He's been talking about the difficulties he's having in getting credit to expand his business. Ken, thanks so much.
All right, well, have a good day.
So there you have it. We're hearing from critics who say a bailout will only help poor people who took out loans they didn't deserve, or rich people who gave out bad loans, but a small businessman saying a bailout will help him. We will continue to follow this story, but we have lots more, everything else that's going on after the news here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A few news notes for you. Former President Bill Clinton's Global Initiative Conference is underway in Manhattan. Clinton launched the conference to come up with solutions to global warming, poverty, and malaria-related deaths worldwide. The former president said the U.S. needs to build alliances around the world to solve these problems.
There is a big understanding in that there's a limit to how much you can get out of military power and that we need more friends and fewer adversaries. There is an enormous understanding. But they need to know what this has produced.
The two presidential candidates both addressed the conference as well. John McCain spoke on several issues, including climate change. He said it is a man-made problem. Democrat Barack Obama, speaking via satellite, also promised action on global warming and pledged to cut extreme poverty in half by 2015. Both candidates will meet with the president and congressional leaders today on the proposed bailout of the financial industry, which, as we've been hearing during the program, is not exactly in stone. So in terms of tomorrow night's planned presidential debate, McCain has said he isn't yet ready to say he'll attend. Obama says he plans to be there. That story has yet to unfold. But when a debate does take place, undoubtedly the candidates will certainly be grilled on security and foreign affairs, including the current situation in Afghanistan. A quick note on that. Today, NATO forces in Afghanistan said Pakistani troops fired at American helicopters that were patrolling the border region. A U.S. military spokesperson said the helicopters did not cross into Pakistan. Pakistan said they did, and that its forces fired warning shots, and then the American helicopters fired back. Well, then there's Iraq, certain also to be on a debate agenda. Today we want to spend some time looking at a side of Iraq that doesn't get much attention, the disabled. 2 million of Iraq's 27 million people are disabled. They're victims of war, disease, birth defects. And in a country in the midst of a war, basic services and transportation for the disabled are hard to come by. The disabled also face another challenge in Iraq. There's a stigma attached to being disabled. Enter Tiana Tozer. She's an American who's used a wheelchair since she was run over by a drunk driver when she was just 20. For the past year, she's been in Baghdad running a disability and gender equality program for the aid group Mercy Corps. We spoke to her while she was on home leave in Portland, Oregon, right before she returned to Iraq last week. She started by telling us how difficult it is to get around Iraq in a wheelchair.
Nearly impossible. Accessibility is practically non-existent.
So what do they do?
They have people help them. They don't go out of their house. They make do. They get by.
And what about the prejudice that they face? You know, there's a whiff of that in everywhere, you know, around the world. But why is it different in Iraq? What do they face?
Well, all around the world, people with disabilities, the biggest barrier they face is attitudes rather than physical barriers. Yeah. And in Iraq, sometimes there's a shame associated with being disabled, particularly with uneducated Iraqis. It's cursed by God if you're born with a disability. Sometimes it's just a shame that your child is not normal. They just face huge barriers as far as attitude goes.
I'm wondering, too, what the medical barriers are, because we know, you know, how reduced the hospital systems have been because of war. Do they get the treatment they need?
Well, I think what you can say is Iraq has an educated medical population, but a lot of them have fled due to the conflict. But the issue is that sometimes the shame factor, they don't want to learn about their disabilities, or the families don't want to learn about their disabilities. So it's not something that's dealt with in an open manner, which contributes to the issues that they face.
A side effect of that is that sometimes people spend their whole lives in one room.
Yes, that has. We have heard stories like that. I've never met someone who's spent their entire life in one room. We did meet a young developmentally disabled boy who was afraid to go out of the house, and a group of my community educators went to his house to visit with him, and their plan is to get him out of the house eventually.
Well, we know your work is focused on helping the disabled be empowered, but how can they do that in this society that able-bodied Iraqis often don't feel empowered, you know, because they don't have electricity, they don't have a job. So how do you do it for the disabled?
Well, that's an interesting question. Empowerment doesn't come from outside things. It comes from internal things. And so what we're doing is we're teaching people how to advocate for themselves. And Americans with disabilities faced the same thing back in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And we had to fight to get accessible schools, to be allowed to attend school. And Iraqis are going to have to do the same thing. And so we're going to teach them how to do it, and we're going to stand by them as they work towards an integrated society.
And they're on their way. We understand there's the Iraqi Alliance of Disability Organization, and they have a motto, nothing about us without us.
Yes, nothing about us without us. There is a tendency for able-bodied people to think they know best for people with disabilities, the father knows best issue. But we can tell you best what our needs are and how to meet those needs. And so we need to be involved in the decisions that are going to affect us.
We understand NBC did a story about your work and showed you speaking to other people in wheelchairs. And there's a scene when you're speaking to a woman and she begins to cry. Who was she and what did you say to her?
Her name is Rana. And the reason that she was crying is because she dropped out of school because the kids were so mean to her and made fun of her disability. And she was explaining how isolated she felt and how unwelcome she felt. And I told her that I understand.
Well, let's just talk briefly about you. You are quite something in your in what you've done since your accident when you were in your 20s. You played on the USA women's wheelchair basketball team, the winning team, we should say, had quite a lot of success. And you also went to Bosnia to teach war veterans there how they might also play basketball in wheelchairs. You know, what's your sense of being disabled?
When you're disabled, you have to advocate for yourself all the time. People have a tendency to sort of sidle up to you and try to relate to what's different with you. Like, oh, you know, I had a knee injury once. And you're like, oh, really? Would you like to tell me about that? Just funny things. Like, I'll be rolling down the street and someone will be looking at me with abject pity. And I'm thinking, how do they know I'm single and I have a cat? And they're thinking, oh, my gosh, that girl, she's in a wheelchair. So you have to have a sense of humor about it. And you have to educate people about your disability. The world is not going to adapt to you. You're the one who's different. You have to adapt to the world.
And you seem to have. I love there's a little video clip of you when you were younger speaking to a school, and you're saying, well, I used to be 6'1", and now I'm 4'1".
Oh, yes, I was 6'1", and I lost an inch in the crash, and when I sit in my wheelchair, I'm much shorter.
Well, and now you're headed back to Iraq for another year. I think many people would say, I wouldn't want to be in Iraq with both legs able to carry me away when something dangerous happened. You're going to Iraq in a wheelchair.
People often think that Iraq is very dangerous, and in one sense it is. But in 2007, 12,446 people in the United States were killed by intoxicated drivers. If the war goes on for 10 more years, we probably won't lose that many Americans in Iraq. So I could be injured here. I could be injured there. I mean, everything is dangerous. Walking down the stairs is dangerous. People are like, oh, we're losing our young people in Iraq. Well, we're losing our young people in the United States, and you can do something about it, you know?
You have become a strong voice against drunk driving.
That was how I became an advocate. I started speaking to young people, educating them about my disability.
Tiana Tozer, she heads the Disability and Gender Equality Program for the A Group Mercy Corps. Tiana, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's a conversation we had before Tiana went back. If you want to know more about Tiana Tozer and her work in Iraq for Mercy Corps, she's there right now. Go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. And one of the educational tools that Tiana Tozer is going to take with her in Iraq is a film about an 8-year-old New Hampshire boy.
Sammy likes spaceships.
His favorite color is yellow.
Including Samuel is a documentary by photojournalist Dan Habib. It tells the story of his son, Samuel, who has cerebral palsy, and the family struggles to ensure that Samuel's disability doesn't exclude him from participating in all activities at home, in school, and in the larger community. Angus Friedenberg has our story.
Samuel Habib sits in his wheelchair struggling to complete a class assignment. His cerebral palsy makes speaking a challenge, and he's having trouble gripping his pencil. You might think this would make attending a regular school an impossibility for Samuel. It doesn't, because Samuel goes to Beaver Meadow Elementary School in Concord, New Hampshire, a public school where, despite his disability, Samuel is included in every class activity. Today, Samuel is sharing a poem he dictated about a cardinal with his classmate Fletcher and his paraprofessional, Cheryl Lampron.
What kind of bird does this sing?
Samuel communicates with his teachers and peers through a combination of language, hand gestures, his expressive brown eyes, and a contagious laugh. He saves his words for when he really needs them. When he has to communicate quickly, or when he's too tired to speak, he uses a pre-recorded push-button device called a voca.
Would like to do money.
Years ago, someone with disabilities like Samuel would have been hauled off to a resource room or special ed classroom for most of the day, or not allowed in public school at all. But at Samuel's school, inclusion means exactly what it sounds like. Everyone in the classroom has value. It doesn't matter how you get around, what language you speak, what color your skin is, or how you communicate. Everyone is included. Barbara O'Brien has been Samuel's teacher for 3 years. She says including everyone prepares her kids for the real world.
We're like a little mini world. We're a little mini community. And when children learn to accept each other's differences and even build on each other's differences and learn from each other, within our classroom they're going to be able to do that in the outside world.
It's not as if Samuel's classmates don't recognize his disability. His friends Madison, Fletcher, and Jacob speak matter-of-factly about it. They acknowledge that including Samuel isn't always easy.
Well, usually outside of school, I have playdates with Samuel, and we don't play games that Samuel can't play, like he can't run really fast, so we usually play baseball instead of tag.
I always want to be reading partners with him, but sometimes when we're doing projects, he picks me, but sometimes I just don't want to be with him. But I do it with him.
It's pretty good to have another classmate that's in a wheelchair, but you have to expect that he's in a wheelchair, so he can't do some things that you can.
It's true. Samuel can't do everything his classmates can do in exactly the same style or at the same speed. But that doesn't mean he can't do them. That's the point Samuel's father, Dan Habib, is trying to make in the film he made about his son, including Samuel. The film is a deeply personal look at the extraordinary efforts Samuel and his family make to ensure he's included in everything.
It takes a lot of creativity to make this work. It takes an aide who knows when to support Samuel in the classroom and when to simply let him be with the other kids.
Ooh, all right.
And it takes a teacher like Mrs. O'Brien, who is constantly thinking about how each student can be involved in every part of the day.
Oh, you ready, Samuel? Come on up, buddy.
The documentary, including Samuel, begins as a story about one boy and one family, then braids together the lives of three other people with disabilities to create a compelling argument for disability rights.
How old are you, Samuel? How old are you?
Should we all help him blow the candles out?
Samuel recently celebrated his 8th birthday, and his family knows that once he leaves Beaver Meadow Elementary School and its intentional cocoon of inclusion, school and life make it harder for him and for them. It's an unknown that sometimes worries Samuel's father, Dan Habib.
Sometimes we really get nervous about that. What's middle school going to be like? What's it like when he's a pimply teenager and he's not so cute anymore, you know? And so I hope that both his peers and his teachers continue to do what's happening right now, which is just seeing him as another kid who loves to learn, who loves the Red Sox, who loves to play, and that his disability is just one small part of who he is.
A report from Angus Friedenberg. For more on the film, including Samuel, go to our website, here-now.org. And in the coming days, the cost of special education. You're listening to Here and Now. Back in a minute. Anna Deavere Smith is here, which means the studio just got crowded with all the voices that live inside her. Anna has won praise, Pulitzer and Tony Award nominations, and a MacArthur Genius Grant for her one-woman theater pieces. In her previous show, Fires in the Mirror, she explored the tensions between Hasidic Jews and blacks in Brooklyn. In Twilight Los Angeles, 1992, she channeled the different voices in Los Angeles after the Rodney King trial. It's all part of her work in progress, On the Road, A Search for American Character, finding and interviewing people, then bringing their words to the stage. In her new show, Let Me Down Easy, A Play in Evolution, Anna Deavere Smith takes on no less than the frailty of the human body and the strength of the spirit. Through dozens of characters, including genocide expert Samantha Power, Harvard chaplain Peter Gomes, genocide survivors in Rwanda, and Ruth Katz, a patient being treated for cancer whose records are lost until she tells the resident she's also the dean of the medical school.
Now he looks up. At this medical school? I said at the Yale School of Medicine. You found my files within a half an hour.
Let Me Down Easy, currently playing at the American Repertory Theater here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, was actually birthed at the Yale School of Medicine. Anna Deavere Smith, we understand when Ralph Horowitz of Yale first asked you to interview doctors and patients about illnesses, you were hesitant.
I really dodged the project until he kind of just said to me, what are you afraid of? And I said I was afraid of making a fool of myself in front of doctors, because the idea was that I would do these interviews and then I would perform at Medical Grand Rounds, which is a pretty high-powered lecture. But I really think what was making me more nervous was just that I knew, given the kind of work that I do, this would call for me to really inhabit or have illness and mortality inhabit me, and that wasn't attractive to me at first. I think I was afraid of that.
You said you were afraid to inhabit the illness, but over the course of the piece, you are someone who's lived through genocide. You are someone who's seen murder. I mean, how does that feel when...
Well, you know, the fact is that it's really what my work or our work as actors is to inhabit all aspects of the human condition. Some of the stories that inhabit me are stories of things that are very, very worrisome. But it doesn't drag me down. It's the opposite. I actually find it invigorating in a kind of a way, because along with all of that sobering news, the play has good news about the resilience of the human spirit.
You also came in touch with former Texas Governor Ann Richards, who combines everything you've just been talking about, spirit, illness. She, as we know, suffered cancer, and that's when you met with her.
I met with her when she was at MD Anderson Hospital in Houston being treated for esophageal cancer.
Is she here now? Can we? I mean, I know it's
hard. Oh, yeah, a little bit. Well, one of the things she talks about, this idea of the spirit for Anne, she says, you know, I'm the first person in the world with esophageal cancer to have this combination of proton therapy and chemotherapy at the same time. My daughter, Ellen, has managed this whole thing for me, so I don't have to use up my chi doing that. Well, that's what it is. That's your life. That's your life force. And you have to save that to beat this physical thing that you have. She just had a way with words, a way with life, a way of understanding the absurd.
I'm thinking of all the people that we meet through the show. You went and spoke to all of them. So you were in the Rwanda.
I went to Rwanda, camps. And you asked me earlier, I haven't counted the characters, but I imagine it's about 30 in this show, somewhere between 25 and 30. I went to Rwanda 10 years after the genocide, really out of the recommendation of my friend Samantha Power, who is well known here in the Cambridge and Boston area. And, you know, because the play was about the human body and its resilience. And she said, well, you know, if you're doing the body, you got to go to Rwanda. So I went and I interviewed people who were victims of the genocide. I interviewed people who were perpetrators. One thing that has haunted me for a long time is one of the Actually, he was my translator, who told me that there's documented evidence, cassettes and all of that, of Hutu politicians calling on Hutus to go out and have their chance to see what a Tutsi woman was like. Mm. There was always a belief in Rwanda that Tutsi women were much more prettier than their Hutu counterparts. And this, of course, encouraged the rep, mass rep everywhere. It was every man's turn, every militia's turn, to have access to what most people had always thought to be a special sort of possession. It was every man's turn to have access to that privilege, as they say. Like they always say, there's a phrase in Rwanda that they always say that watches are Swiss, cars are German, and women are Tutsi. That phrase just haunted me for a long time. That phrase, watches are Swiss, cars are German, and women are Tutsi.
Yeah, and were raped.
Yeah.
Because of it. So what, the overriding idea of grace, where did that come from?
In honesty, my good friend Mike Nichols came to see my show in New Haven, Connecticut.
The filmmaker.
The filmmaker and director. Yeah. And he said, this play is about kindness. And that version of the play had a lot of athletes. I mean, it had, you know, Lance Armstrong, supermodel Veronica Webb, Lauren Hutton. It had people who were well known for what they study and what they can do with the body. And so it was a lot about sort of physical prowess as well. And when he said to me that the play is about kindness, then I thought about the last character in the play, who's a woman who I met in Johannesburg, South Africa, who has an orphanage for children who are dying of AIDS and whose parents are dead. And I think she exemplifies human kindness in the way that she talks about taking care of these children who are sick. And so I then thought about grace as an extension of kindness.
Because what she tells you ultimately, and it's a real kick in the gut, I mean, it just, is...
Don't leave them in the dark.
Yeah, don't leave them in the dark.
Let them know that they're dying. Let them know what's happening to them. Be the shepherd through it. Or Peter Gomes says also, I think it's so beautiful how he puts it, that in the hospitals, you know, as soon as it looks like it's coming to the end of life, the medical people leave. He says they don't want to stick around for the moment of expiration. But that one of the most important things you can do for somebody is to be with them when they die.
Yeah.
So I think that there is grace and elegance and appreciation of the richness of life when we can do that. And this woman does that as her life project. It's phenomenal.
Anna Deavere Smith, journalist, I think we should call you.
I consider myself really a student of real life, and to study particularly the linguistic and behavior and the physical behavior of people, to see what that teaches me about them and about us, and to take a person's words. My grandfather said to me when I was a girl, if you say a word often enough, it becomes you. And I grew up in a racially divided city, and I think part of what I've been trying to do in these years with my On the Road to Search for American Character project is to embody all Americans without the sense that I could only be what I am, which is a 5'10" African-American woman. And now that work has expanded into the world. There are ways to enter the experience of another person. In my case, it's through their words.
Anna Deavere Smith. Her current one-woman show is Let Me Down Easy, a play in evolution. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about it.
No, thanks for taking the time, really. ¶¶